Chapter 11, The Hunters Club. While the Yetis were walking up the long drive to Farley Towers, a meeting was being held inside the house in the gold drawing room, which faced the rose gardens and the terrace at the back. The gold drawing room looked as much as it had looked in Lady Agatha's day. The beautiful Chinese vases were still there, and the embroidered screen. The sacred relic was there too. The other bedsock, the one that the Earl had brought back from Namvidar and slept with under his pillow until he died. But there were other things now, hung on the walls or resting on the furniture, things which would never have been allowed in the house when Lady Agatha was a girl. Heads they were, mostly. The stuffed heads of friendly hippopotamuses and gentle giraffes and thoughtful buffaloes, looking down on the room with sad and glassy eyes. There were skins, too, the skins of slaughtered tigers and zebras and leopards lying on top of the lovely flowered patterned carpet. Sawn-off tusks and antlers were piled above the mantelpiece, and in a glass case the bodies of poor dead fish hung stiffly. The meeting was a big one. There were about 30 people sitting round a huge satinwood table, all of them men, and not one of them was a Farlingham. The lady in the shop had not been lying when she said that Farley Towers still belonged to the Farlinghams. It did, but like many old families, the Farlinghams had become poor. They couldn't afford any longer to keep the acres of the roof mended, or pay gardeners to tend the grounds, or servants to care for the 97 rooms, so they decided to let the house out to a school or a club or a hospital who'd be able to look after it. And their agent, who looked after things for them, had let it to a club. A club that wanted to move from its headquarters in London to a place in the country because it needed more room. The Hunters Club, it was called. The members of the Hunters Club came from all over the world. There were oil sheiks from Iran, film stars from Hollywood, German industrialists, Spanish noblemen, anyone who thought that killing defenceless animals turned you into a real man. It cost £20,000 just to join the club, and the funds were used to buy aeroplanes and motorboats and snowmobiles so that members could go and kill even the rarest animals in the most distant places without anyone being able to stop them. In this way, the hunters had gunned down polar bears on the icebergs of Alaska, practically exterminated the Javan rhinoceroses, and massacred the gentle, dreamy orangutans of Borneo. Sometimes they went off on pig-sticking parties in Spain, running wild boars through the spears and quietly snuffled under the chestnut trees, or they would go fly some African lake and mow down hundreds of gorgeous flamingos from the comfort of their jeeps. "Now then, gentlemen," said the club president, a man called Colonel Bagwackerly, who had a boiled kind of looking face, pop eyes and a sticky moustache which clung like a slice of ginger pudding to his face. "You know, we are here to discuss a very important matter." "A very important matter," yelled the hunters, banging their glasses on the table. They were already rather drunk. "As you know," he went on, "next week is our great club. Our great club is going to be 100 years old." 100 years old, repeated the hunters, hiccuping and slapping each other on the back. "And we are here to decide what kind of hunt we should have for our anniversary celebrations." "A big hunt, the biggest hunt ever," cried the drunken hunters. "Quite so," he said. "The only question is, what shall we hunt and where?" "How about polishing off the rest of the blue whales?" said a black-bearded Scotsman who called himself the MacDermot Duff of Huist and Curra and went around in a blood-red kilt and a sporran hug hung with a dozen dangling badger's claws. But the others shook their head. "Not enough sport," they said, and it was true. So many of these rare and marvellous animals had already been destroyed by greedy whale hunters that you could travel 1,000 miles across the ice-blue waters of the Antarctic and not sight one. "What if we go shtick-picking?" said a German member. But the others shook their heads again. For a big hunt, they wanted something bigger than a pig sticking. Something with guns in it and explosions and blood. One member suggested a kangaroo shoot in Australia, but so many of the kangaroos had already been turned into steaks, that wasn't any good. Someone else suggested the wild camels in Andes, but a revolution was going on in the South America and the hunters liked shooting things, not getting shot. And then a small man with a gold-rimmed spectacles and a pinched pale nose got to his feet. "I know," he squeaked. "I know, I've got a great idea." "What is it?" They had let Mr. Brink belong to the club because he was a very rich saucepan manufacturer and they needed him to buy the helicopters and things like that. but everyone despised him. He was weedy and twittery and had a huge wife called Myrtle Prink, of whom he was dreadfully afraid. Now he tried to jump off his chair. He fell off. And he squeaked, "Yetis! That's what we should hunt! Abominable snowmen! Fly out to the Himalayas and have a great big Yeti hunt." There were groans from the other hunters. And the McDermott Duff of Huish and Kara swore a dreadful oath. "There aren't any such things." "Yes, there are," shouted Mr. Prink. "Look!" And out he took a bundle of newspapers and threw them down on the table. They were the papers that had been printed after Lucy's footsteps had been found in Namvidar, and the headlines said things like, "Abominable snowman stalks again," or "Mysterious creature of the mountain heights," or "It's yes to the Yetis." "Pull yourself together," Prink snarled back at Wackley. "A pack of newspaper lies." "It isn't, I'm sure of it," squealed Mr. Prink. "We could stalk them in the snow and flush them from their lairs and shoot them with exploding bullets. We could have a Yeti skin for the room and Yeti tusks for the armoury." "That's enough," thundered Colonel Backwackley.